Well, good morning, everyone. We're doing Luke 17:18. Hey, I thought just briefly, I know periodically, I know you appreciate little reports on what the high school child is thinking. You know, what are these things that come out when, you know, they're in the classroom that they may not come out at home. We're reading, these are sophomores, they're reading Mere Christianity. They're starting this chapter, We Have Cause to Be Uneasy. Lewis has established that there's some kind of supernatural mind behind the universe, and now he's arguing, well, what is that being like? Because that's, you know, a preparation to getting toward the God of Christianity. How does this mind behind the universe fit with what it is that Christianity teaches? Well, Lewis opens that chapter by saying, well, there are some of you that the moment that you hear that that I'm going to be talking about religion, you say to yourself, well, that's already been tried. The world's tried that, and you can't turn back the clock. One of the interesting things about our young people is they never quite understand Lewis saying that. And I have to tell them, it's because you grow up in the upper Midwest. You grow up, whether it's Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, you are growing up with lots of people going to church. They may go sort of irregularly, but it's normal where you're growing up that people go to church. You have to understand that Lewis is talking about Europe in the 1940s. Regular church attendance collapsed right around the First World War. And so it becomes unusual for people to go to church. And this is what I hear people who visit Europe. You know, the churches are beautiful and empty. You know, and you're in Italy, you're more likely to stumble into another tourist than into an actual live Italian, right, attending church. So the fact that our young people think that church going is pretty normal, you know, that's a good sign of the culture that they live in. And I tell them, growing up in Alaska, the Pacific Northwest in general, Alaska, Washington State, Oregon, Idaho, these are the least churched areas of the country. These are the places with the lowest church attendance in the country. So growing up as an atheist, I never felt odd. I never felt odd as an atheist. There were lots of kids who had no religion at all, no background in religion. I knew people who went to church, but it was just as normal not to go to church as to go. And so Lewis would have been describing more the culture I grew up in than the culture these kids are growing up in. But the second thing I want to share with you is Lewis talks about what can you know about this God just by natural reason, just by what we're available to look at around us as opposed to the Bible and the church. And he says one bit of information that we have is from the universe that he made. Like, you look at this universe, and because the universe is a beautiful place, you would think that this God is an artist. But because this universe is a very dangerous place, you would think that this God is merciless and no friend to man, right? There's just a lot in the universe. The universe can be a frightening place. Students read that. Not only are they surprised by the idea that God could be sort of merciless and no friend to man, because, of course, of their Christian upbringing, telling them God is love, God cares about you, that's jarring to them. But more significantly, that the universe is a frightening place and a dangerous place. They have no idea what that means. And as we unpack it, as they start talking about their own experiences and so on, they are so insulated and so protected by technology that they're even unaware of how dangerous Minnesota is. So they don't really think of the possibility of the car breaking down, the electricity going out, the pipes freezing. They don't really think of sub-zero weather as dangerous. They are just, I almost have to say, clueless about how dangerous the cold is. And I have to say, that was something growing up in Alaska we had hammered into us. Right, they would show us in middle school. We saw films where they would show the effects of frostbite. They would actually show the blackened fingers. They would show surgical instruments cutting the tips of the fingers off. Yes, they drove this stuff home to us because they wanted us to understand this weather can damage you and endanger you in ways. And so they pulled no punches about that. But the other thing that I appeal to is when you were babies into preschool, into early grade school, you got shots for things. What'd you get shots for? And they have to think like typhus, like polio. They can kind of remember polio. MMR. Some of them can't remember what MMR. So okay, measles, mumps, rubella. In other words, you've got to unpack for them the reason that you aren't growing up with people in your grade dying. Is because you're immunized against all these diseases that used to kill children by the tens of thousands, by the hundreds of thousands. So that's the difficulty for our young people. They benefit so much from all these technological advances, but then the problem is they just think of that as the world. They almost think of that as the world, like that's the world. And so if you try to talk about how the world is actually dangerous and so on, they're like hobbits in the Shire. They don't really see that there's anything beyond their protected bubble. They will talk about Providence being a bubble, and I want to tell them, you're in a bubble, all right. But the bubble isn't the Providence bubble. It's the suburban, upscale, low-crime, high-tech bubble. And the problem is, not just most of the world out there, but also most of human history doesn't look like that. So it makes you an oddball to the human race, to the entire human race, when you're so insulated from the experiences that are simply normal for people in what we would call the third world, the developing world, and like every era before the 1950s. Anyway, so that's the report from the front. Good things and things that sometimes are not easy to break through. Let's look at 1718. I didn't put in as a bullet point the opening of 17, which talks about scandal. It's a helpful passage because it helps remind us what scandal is. Very often we talk about something being scandalous. We mean synonymously shocking, sensational. You know, that's what scandal is for us. And that is almost the very opposite of what scandal is. Where is it? Wait a minute, it talks about forgiveness. Hey, where's my scandal? Oh, I must be over on 18. So I'm going to jump to 18 real quick because I just said it. Temptation, oh, woe to him. Thank you. There it is. Because then I looked over at Jesus blessing the little children on the other page. Thank you. I doubted myself. I shouldn't have doubted myself. I should have believed it. Should have believed all those children's shows that I watched. They were always telling me to believe in myself. Temptations to sin are sure to come. Woe to him by who they come. It would be better for him if a millstone was put round his neck and he were cast in the sea than he'd cause one of those little ones to sin. So in other words, scandal is not I do something that shocks people, because the fact that they're shocked would mean they still are retaining their sense of what's right, they're still retaining their sense of shame. Scandal comes in when it's like your bad example, people look at it and say, well, if he's doing it, then I guess we can do it too. You know, that there's something scandalous when the lower school kids, there they are all in a line, and they see those upper school kids just milling around. Why can't we mill around? Why aren't they putting those upper school kids in line order? Okay, try it. try it sometime. In any event, scandal is when you are giving an example that leads people astray. That's what scandal is. So there isn't a shock. There isn't a surprise. There's just this feeling that, yes, I was told that this was wrong, or I've always sort of felt it was wrong, but now the barrier, and very often that barrier of shame, if there are enough people who are doing something, that provides a kind of permission for the rest. There's maybe this is a good point to bring up, if you're familiar with this, the Durkheim constant. This goes back to the sociologist Emile Durkheim, and I read about it first in a book by Robert Bork, Slouching Toward Gomorrah. He uses it at the beginning of the book. But this is what Emile Durkheim argued, that There's going to be a certain amount of behavior that a society can label as deviant, as bad. But there's a kind of a critical number, and he says it's about less than 5%. You can have the deviant behavior that we don't socialize with you, we shun you, we put you at a distance. If it's less than 5%, once that so-called deviant behavior gets to about 5%, then the society redefines it as no longer deviant. And the reason that the society does that is because you can't have more than 1 in 20 people that you come in contact with being shunned. You can't treat more than 1 in 20. That just becomes too uncomfortable. So once there's enough of whatever that deviant or bad behavior is, you've got to be pretty thick-skinned if you're willing to encounter what the society around you considers considers good behavior, or at least okay behavior, and you consider it misbehavior. You got to be pretty tough, thick-skinned to be able to say, nope, don't talk to me about this bad thing you're doing because I think it's bad and this is disturbing to me or offensive to me. Or that's hard for a lot of people to do.
Just standards, even. Like, you think of what was PG or PG-13.
Sure. So bad language. I remember years ago these girls showing a video to Bill Stevenson, and the video had the F word in it. And they say, "Oh, she says something naughty here. Don't pay attention to that." There is no, if I was not somebody growing up in the 70s and 80s that minded my P's and Q's, I don't think I was terribly respectful or polite, or I never would have played something for a teacher that had the F word in it. That would have just been over the top. But this was here. this was a Providence. These were Providence girls. And girls, not guys. So that shows you that there's just far less shame about language than there was even in the 70s and 80s, which I don't think of as a kind of a, you know, high water mark of faith and morals. There are all sorts of times that I actually get nostalgic, as it were, for the 70s and 80s in terms of the limitations that we're operating. And again, I grew up in this era which the counterculture was triumphant, right? I think about my childhood in the 70s and 80s of, you know, Mad Magazine and National Lampoon, and, you know, that was what ruled. Mel Brooks, that was what ruled. Yeah, that was what ruled the roost. And even then, I look back, and there was a kind of restraint being exercised, which isn't exercised now. Yep. Even Saturday Night Live from the 70s starts to look conservative. Bill Murray? Chevy Chase? Really? John Belushi? But there it is. So, let's turn to this line that happens. Where is this? Here we go. So verse 10. He's going through and helping them understand the duties of the Christian life. But again, kind of anticipating what happens with the Pharisee. You don't want to look at these duties and then get some kind of self-satisfaction out of it. And so he says to them, verse 7, "Any of you as a servant plowing, keeping sheep, say to him when he comes in from the field, 'Come at once, sit down at my table.' Would he rather not say, 'Prepare supper for me, put on your apron and serve me till I eat and drink, and afterwards you shall eat and drink?' Do you thank the servant because he did what he was commanded? So you, when you have done all that is commanded, say, 'We are unworthy servants. We have only done what was our duty.'" Alapide, when he comments on this, says, you know, we should imbibe the spirit in ourselves, because we need to be aware that there are these, as he puts it, debts. That it's like we come into the world with debt. And so when we are following God's will, that isn't something where we start like putting on our own merit badges, right? Like Cub Scouts, right? I got my wolf badge, my bear badge, my golden arrow, my silver arrow. No, you shouldn't be celebrating yourself for that. You are someone who owes, you know, far more than you're ever going to be able to pay back. You know, creation, the debt of creation, the debt that you owe to God just from being brought into the world, you know, and being brought into the world as a human being. I mean, the same matter that occupies you could be a frog or a toadstool, that you are brought into the world as a human being, you know, you can't pay that back. That you've been redeemed. So not just brought into the world and sort of left with your fallen nature, but that God, right, brought that nature out of its woundedness and began to heal you. The debt you have when you make your baptismal promises. Okay, now it could be that somebody made those promises for you, you know, because you were baptized as a baby, but that's why it is that at baptisms, you're repeating the promises. Because maybe that first time, yeah, you didn't say them on your own, but eventually you have to own it. Eventually, as a Christian, you're saying those, making those promises yourself. And then finally, that not just in terms of nature, like when you think of creation, they brought you into the world, but that God is your ultimate beginning and your ultimate end. That you come from Him and you're meant to go back to Him. You know, that's, as it were, the greatest debt of all. So that when you look at what it is you do and what it is you strive to do and so on, you always have to be aware of the gap between where you're supposed to be and where you're at. I think in the modern world, that's hard for us because we live in an age of constant affirmation. We live in an age in which we're always supposed to kind of boost ourselves, make ourselves feel good. If you're feeling bad about yourself, there's something wrong about that. You may need drugs, you may need therapy. You should always be kind of feeling good about yourself. But the thing that when you read Lives of the Saints, they are not people who are feeling good about themselves. To the extent they have some kind of good feeling, their good feeling is in God. Their good feeling is rejoicing in this being that loves them. That's where their joy is coming from. And so that's why they can be very dissatisfied with themselves, but they are not somehow depressed, anxious, in need of counseling. They can be dissatisfied with themselves because they're not keeping their eye on themselves. They're keeping their eye on God. They're keeping their eye on this good outside themselves. I think about that. There was a time, probably when I was about 15 or so, and I was just being the moody teenager, you know, being moody around. And my father's asking, "What's wrong? Don't you ever feel as though like there's no point? Like you just feel sad, just feel adrift and alone." And my father, he just looks me over and says, "You know, son, I could feel that way, but the fact is I'm too busy because I've got a job and I've got a family to take care of and I'm married and I don't have time to sit around and mope." Implication, why don't you like go do your homework or clean your room or something, and then you won't be just sitting around moping. So there's a lot, I think, of the modern unhappiness that really goes back to just hyper-focus on ourselves. If we got off ourselves, then we would have the opportunity for greater joy, but we'd also have the opportunity for real humility, because the humility wouldn't crush us. You know, because we wouldn't be trying to get happiness from ourselves or based on how we feel about ourselves. Our joy would come from other things. Now, it's right after this episode that Jesus cures these lepers. And one of the things that commentators point out, the way that the lepers cry out to a master, they don't cry out to him, Rabbi. They call out to him as master because it's as if they're acknowledging this is someone with supernatural power. They're not looking to be taught. They're looking to be healed. So they are like in the storm. Remember when the apostles are at sea and the wind's knocking them about? Lord, do you not see that we are about to perish? You know, they appeal to him as Lord. Even then, they don't fully seem to get it, because once he stills the storm, then they say, "Who is this man that the sea and wind obey him?" So they kind of get it and they kind of don't. But in a way, they reflexively know the right way to appeal to him, because they know that they are appealing to some kind of divine power. Why they call on him? Remember, you're told they call him at a distance, because as a leper, you weren't allowed to go near people. The thing that's easy to forget, by the way, about leprosy, remember, it's not just that you were socially marginalized, you were smelly. You You know, leprosy smelled. You're dying on your feet. You're smelling. You're corrupting. You're going bad. You're rotting. So you always, even in an era where everybody didn't bathe as often, so there's lots of BO to go around, with leprosy, it really stands out. Why does Jesus tell them? He tells them that they'll be healed, but he says, go to the priests. Why does he do that? Well, there are several reasons. One, Jesus still wants to show honor to the priesthood. Remember, we talked about this with the presentation and purification. Strictly speaking, you know, Jesus doesn't need to be circumcised. Strictly speaking, Our Lady doesn't need to be purified. But they are going to honor the rituals and the institutions that God has established. They're still going to honor those, and they want other people to honor them. Okay? Remember that the priests are important for the lepers' return to society. They've got to, as it were, be certified as cured before they're allowed to return. It's a model of faith and obedience. Remember, because they aren't healed right away. He just tells them, go to the priests. They go to the priests with the understanding that they're going to somehow be healed on the way, even if it's not happening right then. They just head off, trusting that they're going to be cured before they get there. And finally, then the priests themselves become a witness of the miracle, right? That these people who everybody knew to be lepers, and now they're cured, they provide evidence of that. They provide witness of it. Now, the thing that happens in the cure is that of all of these folks who are cured, a Samaritan runs back to thank Jesus. And Jesus remarks, weren't all 10? I seem to recall there were 10 lepers here before. Did you count differently than I did? Why has only this stranger come back? And remember, it's very easy to forget the animosity, or rather to keep in mind the animosity there is between Jews and Samaritans. Because if you pride yourself on the purity of your heritage, that you are part of the people. Remember, what makes a Jew is that you are born from a Jewish mother. You know, it's that you're a child of Abraham. It's birth. And those people who live in Samaria, they're mongrels. They're mutts. They're like the Syrians that Salmanasar planted in there. And maybe there were still some Jews around, but they're just, you know, it's almost like the way we talk about, or horror movies will have, like the dangerous hillbillies. You know, who are they really even human? It's almost like that, like the way you look at the like in John Borman's Deliverance. You know, with the banjo scene. It's almost like they look at those people like that. They are. Are they really even human? But this stranger is the one who comes back and thanks. And why is that? One of the commentaries I read talked about how it is that the odd thing about being a stranger is that you don't take it for granted. You know, that Jesus healed you, a Samaritan. This could to you be amazing, and that you go back and think. But for the others, do they have this idea that somehow, in a way, they deserve it? In a way, this is what they should have. This is the way it should be. Whenever you're receiving something that somehow deep down you really think you should have had this all along, then you don't have the same spirit of gratitude. One of the things that I when I read this passage, when I read that observation, I think of a friend of mine who did youth ministry for many, many years. And he talked about how it is that it was always easier working with public school kids than Catholic school kids. The public school kids, yeah, they don't know as much, but they're grateful for you being there. You're telling them these things that oftentimes they haven't heard and thought about. And the Catholic school kids, they always have a kind of insolence to them. They always have the feeling that they know it already. You know, what are you telling me? I know this already. There can be a little bit of that, I think, going on here, that we have it already. You You take what you have received for granted. And again, especially this is the point I was making earlier with, you know, about technology. The difficult thing about children is whatever it is they grow up with, remember, that's their world. That's what the way it necessarily is, and it can't be otherwise. They don't have enough life experience to realize either how temporary or fragile or, you know, this thing around them is. Because it's always, from their point of view, it's always been that way. And the only way you can get a kid out of that is if you give them some kind of alternate experience. One of the faculty members I was talking to said that for him, one thing that really helped is his mom sent him on this trip to Jamaica to help these religious brothers who minister to poor people in Jamaica. And he said, and it was basically, it was this home for old homeless men who really couldn't take care of themselves. So he said, I was there for, you know, this is in the middle of the summer, I was there for how many weeks, and I was like changing diapers. You know, I was cleaning people. I was doing these things that were completely out of the realm of what it is I did. And he would have been 19, like 19, 20. And he said, you know, this was just a completely different set of experiences that I grew up with. And it's almost, for some kids, it's almost like they need something like that to sort of break the barrier of the complacent, comfortable, suburban existence, which for them is the world. That's what the world is, because they don't... Okay, even when you take them on vacation, okay, well, if you take them to the resort, then the resort just becomes an extension of the... I will never forget asking, this would have been like the first year or two I was here, asking, have you seen real poverty? I don't mean like one car, one TV, government payment poverty. I mean, have you seen people who are destitute? And this one girl raised her hand, oh yes, when we went to Jamaica and we're on the tour bus and we're going up to the resort, you could see these shanties on either side. And okay, so she saw poverty from the tour bus. I mean, that's better than not having seen it at all, but that was almost, you know, it was a kind of a drive-by poverty, you know, yeah, poverty tour. Go ahead, Barbara.
I was curious, so was the Samaritan leper, was he the only Samaritan?
Apparently.
But he could hang with the other lepers.
Well, you know, the thing is, once you're all rotting together and dying together, some of those distinctions become less significant. Because you just, as a leper, you have to depend on each other just to survive, because you're all there is. No, you know, people are not going to help you out. They are not going to help you out. I mean, think about how recently, you know, when you read about Damien de Voyster, you know, that's like the early 20th century. And there are these leper colonies in Molokai. You know, people don't want them around in the modern world any more than they wanted them around 2,000 years ago.
But interesting that they got the
Jewish lepers.
The Jewish lepers, but they when they were down in the bottom, like in the gutter.
Yep.
Then they were able to accept another leper.
Yep. And it's often the case.
Yeah.
I will say this. It's not quite the same thing, but you know, when people talk about multiculturalism and having lots of races and cultures together, I have to say that the people who sort of talk the most about that, they're people out in rich white suburbs. And it's like lily white in every direction. And even when they deal with so-called colored or brown people, they're brown people who have the same kind of education, income level, and jobs that they do. So I guess the culture comes out at dinner, you know, where they're eating different things. I think if you go to, as I do, like every other week, you go to an Asian food store in Brooklyn Park, and there are American blacks, immigrant blacks, Chinese, Central Americans, Mexicans, all trying to make each other, trying to understand each other in English, which is clearly a second language for all these people. You want to see multiculturalism, go to an Asian food store in Brooklyn Park. But when you're out in the suburbs, you're not going to go to a place like that. You know, generally you're not. You know, you're going to go to your more boutique grocery store. multiculturalism, where it really is cultures all sort of pushed together. That's what it looks like. It's usually lower income. It's smellier. It's not as boutique. And you get to see actually some friction as these people are trying to relate to each other with their different customs and different languages. You know, and these are people who don't look like they made it through high school. You know, some of these people I think probably made it through grade school, and that was probably it. But you want to see multicultural? Here, there it is. That's what it looks like. It isn't just sort of comfortable and stylish, and it's not just the food. Now, I wanted to. Whenever I read this, I'm always reminded of this text from Saint Ignatius of Loyola about gratitude. And let me get this. This was a text I first ran into, believe it or not, when I was out at Boston College. Boston College still holds on to its Jesuit heritage. And I had heard that St. Ignatius at one point talked about how it is that the worst sin is ingratitude. And I had to track down this text. Hold on a second. Moody. Maybe if you did more as an iPad, you'd be less moody. Okay, so here's a letter from St. Ignatius of Loyola to the head of the Jesuits in Portugal. This is right after he started the Jesuits. Here's what he says. Considering in his divine goodness and ready to defer to better judgment, how of all the imaginable evils and sins, one that most merits the loathing of our Creator and Lord and of every creature capable of his everlasting glory is the sin of ingratitude, being as it is the refusal to acknowledge the goods, graces, and gifts that we have received. And so, the cause and principle and source of every evil and sin. And now, on the other hand, acknowledgement and gratitude for the goods and gifts received is so highly loved and esteemed, both in heaven and earth. I thought I should recall to you how, since our arrival in Rome, we have had in numerous matters enjoyed the full and continuous favor of the Pope, receiving special benefits from His Holiness, and how at the same time, how clear to the entire society and to yourself, who are present there, and most manifestly of all, the extent what we all owe to our King, your Lord and ours in the Lord. Okay? So there's St. Ignatius saying, I'm willing to be talked out of this, but it just seems to me that the foundation of so many evils for people is that they're basically ungrateful. And the source of so many goods, the starting point of so many good things, is that you are able to look at what you have and be grateful. And so St. Francis de Sales, one of his meditations in prayer, is just stopping and thinking, just going through in your mind, almost creating a kind of a litany of the blessings that you have in your life. Right? Just list them. Sit down with a piece of paper, you know, and just write down all the things that you enjoy that you're very clear. You could look around and see that they could be otherwise. You know, whether it's the health of your family, whether it's the, you know, who you married, things in your children, things in where you live. You know, there are things that I really do complain about in terms of, especially the winter in the Twin Cities. And I know I'm complaining, and it's hard for me to stop complaining about it. Yes, you will tell me, you grew up in Alaska. Doesn't that give me every reason in the world to be sick of it? You know, why do I keep living in these cold places? But the fact is, you know, once you factor in this school, you know, what my children have been able to have at this school, the churches that we've been able to go to. There are all sorts of problems here and there with the church and the archdiocese, but the fact is there are a lot of wonderful priests here and there are a lot of wonderful parishes. Things over at University of St. Thomas and St. Paul School of Divinity, where I teach periodically, the fact is I have a lot to be grateful for. And yes, I can sit there and keep daydreaming about that house in Arizona. Even Texas starts to sound appealing. But the...
Texas.
Yeah. But the fact is, there are many, many things which we meaning, you know, me and my family, that we have here that I don't know that we would have in some other place. So, shut up, suck it up, buttercup. It's going to be cold, but there are a lot of things that you enjoy because you live here. Let's look at the beginning of 18, the unjust judge. And notice I put there, edgy parables. Don't try to make up your own parables. You know, when I've heard pastors do this, and they always end up sounding sappy and saccharine. They always end up sounding, they feel as though a parable is like a children's story, so it's like they write their own children's story. Here's this unjust judge. And basically, he's not giving this woman what she wants, because like all unjust judges, he's looking for a bribe. But he realizes, this woman is just going to wear me out. I'm going to decide in her favor because, you know, it's just, she's not going to let me sleep. She's not going to let me be. And the point of the parable is not that you should be, don't try to bribe, just like terrorize the guy. No, the point of the parable is that the determination that this woman has, that's the kind of determination you should have in prayer. Right, so remember, all of these parables, they always have something edgy, a little dark, there's always some form of bad behavior in them, but you are supposed to draw out some kind of example, not the badness of the bad behavior, but a certain aspect of it. And in this case, it's her perseverance. You've got to treat God almost like He's not listening to you, and you are just going to hold on to him like a Rottweiler. You are just going to keep praying and keep praying and keep praying until God gives in. Okay? Now, again, it presupposes that you're praying for the right thing. Sometimes God always answers prayer. Sometimes the answer is no, and the answer is no for good reason. But nonetheless, those prayers aren't wasted. It's not like he's looking down on you. Oh my gosh, she's asking for this thing. I'm never going to get it. I don't know why she keeps it up, because he can at least recognize that, you know, what the spirit behind the prayer. And the spirit behind the prayer always has to be, God, I know that you are good, and I know that if this is truly good, you will give it to me. Okay. And it could be the way he's answering the prayer is, no, this is actually not good for you in the way you think it is. But by all means, keep praying. Keep praying. At least it's keeping you out of trouble. Keep praying. The publican and the Pharisee. I started to talk about this last time, and I talked about it in the context of, who were those two people we were talking about? Oh, because I was talking about how you have to put them together. Who are the two people? Oh, that's right, the prodigal son and the brother. In a way, you have to think of them as two halves as something complete. So the prodigal son, yes, he's got this bad behavior, but at least he has real contrition and real humility. The son, the elder son, yes, he stayed at home, so he's got the duty, but he's got the duty combined with apparently some kind of sense of entitlement and resentment. And it's like at the time I said, you got to put those together. You've got to have real humility, real contrition for sin, but you've also got to do things. You do have to have some kind of obedience, right, to the will of God that shows itself in some kind of work. Likewise, the publican and the Pharisee. The Pharisee, when he says, I fast three times a week, I pray, these are all things that are really good to do. He's not bad because he's praying and fasting and whatnot, giving alms. That's what he should be doing. But the problem is that Pharisee, he thinks he's good from himself, that he's good from his own merits. He is all about self-affirmation. And you have to take the text as it's given to you, that really he is saying this aloud. I think sometimes when we read the passage, we just think, well, when people pray, I mean, they don't, like, pray aloud. No, the text seems to imply, and the practice tended to be, that you did pray aloud. Thank God I am not like that publican back there. I know, that just sounds so rude. But that's the degree of self-satisfaction that this guy has. It's almost like he looks back at the publican, who let him in here? So that he takes pride in his achievements, that he thinks of them from himself, and that you will see this term, that he has this desire for singularity. You know, we live in a society that's all about freedom, and so it's always talking about being unique. When you look, however, at the spiritual life, the desire to be unique is bad. That's called the sin of singularity. You don't want to, as it were, stand out, draw attention to yourself, focus on how special you are, right? Those are not, that is not the right way of thinking. You're always thinking about conformity to the will of God. Now, conformity to the will of God, in fact, will make you unique. You will stand out. But you don't do it for the sake of standing out. You don't do it for the sake of being singular. That's where the problem comes in. It's just like, it's similar to where St. Thomas will talk about, is it a sin to be a bishop? Is it a sin to want to be a bishop? Is it a sin to want to be a bishop and desire that? And the answer St. Thomas gives is, yes. If you were aware of the great spiritual responsibility that's involved in being a bishop, it'd be crazy for you to want to do that. Because you lead your diocese astray, you make the wrong decisions, that's on you. That's on you. Like giving a bad example as a parent, that's on you. The reason that you discern and accept the episcopacy is in obedience to God's will. You're being obedient to God, putting you in the direction of the diocese. But that you would sort of want that on your own, there's something wrong with you. By the way, even in Plato's Republic, Socrates will talk about how it is that we should be ruled by people who don't want to rule. Right? Even when Plato talks about philosopher kings, the philosopher king does not rule because he wants to rule. If anything, it takes away from what he does as a philosopher. He wants to rule because he doesn't want to be ruled by people worse than himself. He doesn't want to be ruled by people who are just ambitious, greedy, bossy. I met a young woman who was a political science major at Boston College years ago, and I asked her why. She said she wanted to go to Washington and get involved with politics. And I asked her why, and she said, because I like telling people what to do and I'm good at it. Yes, and I did not say, because my mother always said civility, manners. I did not say, the first thing that came into my mind, you are absolutely the last person that I would want in politics and that I would want exercising some sort of political authority. I like telling people what to do and I'm good at it. Heaven help us from being ruled by people like that. We want to be ruled by people like Cincinnatus, right? This ancient Roman figure. They make him dictator. He saves the Republic. They want him to keep ruling. Nope, I've saved the Republic. And he goes back to his farm, right? He rules because he has to, because the common good requires it. And the moment he doesn't, he goes back to his cows. Okay, well, there are more things probably to say about that, but we will continue next time with 19 and 20. Oh, what is it, Mrs. Lyons?
I just have a quick question, not related, well, kind of related to some of the other stuff, but can you give a quick synopsis of why the priest in Phoenix had to resign because he used the wrong word in baptisms?
Well, I don't know about it, but I know in this archdiocese, there were two parishes that were doing Creator, Redeemer, Sanctifier, and it's invalid. The form from the Bible, regardless of Eastern Church, Western Church, is it has to be Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Now, I don't know what this priest in Phoenix...
He said, we baptize you instead of...
No, it has to be I.
Why is that a resignable offense?
Because it's invalid. It has to be I, because the priest is acting in persona Christi. So it can't be a we. Just like, by the way, for years when we had that absurd translation of we believe in God the Father. No. A statement of belief is a personal act. We aren't like a hive mind, like the Borg reciting the... Yeah. No. When you are reciting, it has to be you. I. Just like when you sign legal documents, it's I, your name. So that's why.
So then all those people in the 9 years who did it, are their baptisms invalid? Or
yes. By the way, they had to do that here. They had to baptize all these people from these two parishes here over a 20-year period or whatever it was. Yeah?
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Stop. Yeah.